TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The End of Growth. Richard Heinberg is considered one of the foremost experts on fossil fuel depletion. He's the author of 10 books, including The Party's Over and Peak Everything. The End of Growth is his latest, and he came to Mendocino, California in December 2011 to talk to and exchange ideas with the Mendocino Coast Transition Towns Movement. He opened up a line of reasoning that was very intriguing, the connection between the debt crisis and the energy crisis. Richard Heinberg.
Thank you all for showing up this evening. It's great to have a full house. I have written a number of books on resource depletion, often focusing on the economic impacts. Back in 2008, it became clear to me that we were no longer talking about something that might happen in the relatively near future, that the situation has changed. We're talking about a process that is unfolding as we speak. I chose to frame that process in terms of the end of growth. Talking here, of course, of economic growth as we've known it, especially over the past century, and especially as we've known it since about 1945. We've come to think of economic growth as normal and natural, as something that we depend upon for the health of our economy. In the book, I assert that this economic growth that we've come to rely upon is in fact ending, and that it's doing so because of the convergence in real time of what I call the three Ds: debt, depletion, and disaster, natural disaster and industrial accidents. And I'm going to unfold for you these factors for a few minutes. In order to understand the context of economic growth, I think we have to start with energy, because energy is the heart of the economy. Without energy, nothing happens. And over human history, most of our time has been spent using energy from the sun, harvested by green plants and nature, and processed through animals and ourselves and other humans. We've exerted energy into our environments, mostly through muscle power, either human muscles or the muscles of domesticated animals. And that meant that our economies grew only very, very slowly, if at all, because they were economies that were based on local renewable energy. Now, all of that changed over the course of the last 100, 150, 200 years. As we develop the ability to extract and use fossil fuels. We had known about fossil fuels for a long time previously, but it required the invention of metallurgy and gears and simple heat engines, steam engine, in order to be able to use fossil fuels. And once we gained that ability, all hell broke loose. One way to think about the power of fossil fuels is to remember the last time you ran out of gas in your car and had to push your car maybe 10 feet off to the side of the road. That's hard work. Now imagine pushing your car 30 miles down the road. That's really a lot of work. That's the equivalent of something like 10 weeks of hard labor. We get that done for us, pushing a car 30 miles down the road, we get that done for us with a single gallon of gasoline, for which we're paying $4 and complaining. Now think about that. The energy equivalent of 10 weeks of hard labor for $4, what a bargain. It's because energy has been so cheap, so abundant, so concentrated over the past century or so, that we have replaced human labor with fuel-fed machines. In so many instances, we've mechanized transportation and production in every way we possibly could, and that has given us enormous economic benefits. Over the past millennium or two, empires have risen and fallen, but really the total size of economic output of human societies on planet Earth has not changed that much until the last century or two, and suddenly it's practically off the charts. But of course, we're also talking about lots more people. So if we look at GDP per capita and the increase, then we also have to multiply that per capita increase in wealth by a sevenfold increase in capitas. We now have 7 billion human beings. So the total increase in wealth has been absolutely astounding just over the last couple of hundred years. Now, how did we use this abundance of cheap, concentrated energy? Well, in lots of ways. One way we used it was to start making more things, more consumer products. And we found that using powered assembly lines, we could make stuff faster than people could buy it. Now, in the early part of the 20th century, most people were still accustomed to buying things with cash. And big ticket items, especially like automobiles, were a big investment. Not many people were able to afford to buy a new automobile. Not many people had that much cash sitting around. So here was a problem. Powered assembly lines could make automobiles so fast and so abundantly that they could make enough for everybody to have one, but not many people could afford to buy one or even realize that they needed one. How to solve that problem? Two strategies. First, advertising. Talk people into wanting them really, really badly. And there were sub-strategies that went along with advertising, like planned obsolescence. You know, making stuff so that it would reliably break down after a certain amount of time so you'd have to replace it. Or change its appearance every year or two so that everybody would want to have the latest Ford or iPad or whatever. And that turned out to be an enormously successful strategy. And over the decades, the advertising industry ballooned from this very, very small little appendage of society to an enormous industry that processes hundreds of billions of dollars a year and has changed the consciousness of human beings. And especially using the modern communications technologies like television and so on. The other strategy besides advertising that we deployed in order to enable more people to buy more stuff faster was consumer credit. Make it easier for people to go into debt to buy stuff now. They could consume now and pay later, right? Pushing consumption forward in time. Again, this was a very effective strategy. And over the course of the 20th century, the total amount of consumer debt ballooned. Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, money was still connected with precious metals, gold and silver. But as the economy began to grow and grow and grow, it became apparent that there just wasn't enough gold and silver around to facilitate all the trade that otherwise could happen. So the solution to that was to decouple money from precious metals. And this is a process that worked its way out over the course of the 20th century. And by the mid-1970s, the last connections had been severed. And by this time, money was equivalent to debt. And this is strictly true. If you go into the bank and take out a loan, the banker doesn't, you know, let's say it's a loan of $10,000. The banker doesn't go into the vault and search around for $10,000 that happens to be sitting there that somebody else deposited. No, the banker enters a few keystrokes on the computer and calls $10,000 into existence that did not exist previously. This is how money is created, through the making of loans. Now, unfortunately, the interest that you're ultimately going to pay on that loan is not created at the same time. So how does this work? Where does the interest come from? Well, it comes from other people elsewhere in the economy also taking out loans, and then we're all doing business with one another one way or another, working for each other or selling stuff to each other. And as long as the total amount of debt is growing, then theoretically there should be enough new money being created all the time to repay the existing debt plus interest. The only problem happens if growth stops or the rate of growth declines below the interest rate. And then we run into a problem and we see lots of defaults occurring within society, folks who can't pay back their loans. So in effect, tomorrow's growth is collateral for today's debt. We all believe or want to believe that the economy can continue to grow into the indefinite future in order to stave off default and economic collapse, which would otherwise occur if we didn't have economic growth. So in effect, our entire economy has become a sort of pyramid scheme or confidence game, if you want to look at it that way, because we all have to share the confidence that the economy will continue to grow. And economists measure this, consumer confidence index, right? This is very important. What's the level of our confidence these days? Up until the 1980s, debt was growing just about as fast as GDP, and this was the perfect situation. Debt was growing, but as long as GDP was growing at the same rate, then the existing debt could always be repaid. Now, starting in the 1980s, things began to go a little haywire. What happened in the 1980s? Globalization began as a result of the introduction of container ships, satellite communications, computer monitoring of inventories. We began to see much higher volumes of international trade in commodities and manufactured goods. So this meant, in effect, that American workers were increasingly competing directly with workers in Mexico, China, and other countries. So this had the effect, of course, people in those countries were typically earning much less, so this had the effect of driving down wages for American workers or putting downward pressure on those wages so that hourly wages for American workers basically have been stagnant since the mid-1970s on average. So here's a problem. If we require constant growth, and 70% of the economy by this time is consumer spending, and everybody wants to buy more stuff, we're still being advertised at 24/7. Everybody wants a bigger house and a bigger car and flat screen TVs and skis and everything you can imagine. Well, how are we going to make all of that happen? With more debt. And so over the course of especially the last 40 years, new ways of going into debt, more easier ways of going into debt have been created by the financial industry. Credit cards have become, of course, ubiquitous. Lots more people owning their own homes, well, actually not owning them outright, but having mortgages. The banks made it easier for people to take on mortgage debt. And then second mortgages and home equity lines of credit. So starting in the 1980s, debt is growing faster than GDP. Virtually every year, I think every year but two, since 1980, debt has grown faster than GDP. So what does this mean? It means the financial industry is growing. How so? Well, if you're taking out a loan, for you, the debtor, that loan is an obligation, right? But from the standpoint of the bank, that same loan is an asset. So as all of this debt is growing, this is, in effect, is providing the banks and the financial industry with enormous new assets, which they then leverage by means of new financial products that are traded only within the financial industry through securitization, derivatives. So the total amount of debt within the financial industry balloons. And the metaphor is very apt because what starts to happen is the blowing of bubble after bubble. speculative bubbles. In the 1980s, there was the savings and loan debacle, and toward the end of the 80s, we had a real estate bubble, and then in the 1990s, we had an internet bubble, and then in the early 2000s, the biggest real estate bubble of all. And as the financial industry is growing in size relative to the rest of the economy, in comparison to manufacturing and farming and all the rest, it's also gaining political power. The financial industry is contributing more and more to the campaigns of politicians. And those politicians then repay that favor by deregulating the financial industry. Okay, so the financial industry had been laboring under some regulations that had been put in place all the way back in the 1930s in order to prevent the kinds of financial bubbles that happened in the 1920s that led to the Great Depression. So those regulations were removed, and as that happened, the bubbles that we started seeing in the 1980s and 90s and 2000s, each one got bigger until we got to 2008 and the biggest bubble burst of all. So this is a picture of U.S. debt from roughly 1980 to the present. All categories of debt have grown. We've been talking in this country and around the world for the last couple of years a lot about government debt and the problem of government debt. Government debt for decades was not growing any faster than consumer debt or corporate debt or debt within the financial industry itself. It's only when we get to 2008 that suddenly other categories of debt start to decline and government debt starts to increase. This is net year-over-year growth in private and public debt. So, you know, take total new debt and subtract debt that's being paid off and defaulted upon. This is new debt. So starting in 2008, virtually all new debt is in the public sector, government debt. So what's happening is that debt within the private sector is contracting. And remember, if that's all that's happening, then that means the economy is starting to feed on itself and will collapse. So in order to prevent that from happening, the government becomes the borrower and spender of last resort in order to keep that collapse from occurring. That's what happened in 2008, 2009. Now, we've been talking a lot about economic growth, and we can't talk for long about economic growth without acknowledging the fact that there have been very intelligent people who've been warning us for some time that economic growth actually can't go on forever. The Limits to Growth, it's a book that I read when I was 21 years old, and it deeply impacted me at the time, and I think my whole adult life has been colored by my response to this book. It's the best-selling environmental book of all time. It was published in 1972, and it was the effort of a team of scientists to use computer modeling to depict the interaction between population growth, resource depletion, and environmental impacts. Of course, they were using a primitive computer and primitive software and whatever data they could find back in 1972. When they programmed this data into their software and their computer, the standard run scenario showed a peak and decline in world industrial output, i.e. economic growth, sometime in the first two decades of the 21st century. Well, when they saw that, they said, oh my gosh, this is horrible. What can we do? So they tweaked the scenario in various ways. They doubled Earth's resources in the input data. They programmed in government policies to reduce population growth or to rein in pollution. And by doing these things, they were able to push industrial collapse forward in time by a couple of decades, so that instead of occurring in 2020, it happened in 2050. Right? But the same basic scenario kept coming up again and again, no matter how they tweaked the input data. So we've been warned. We've been warned for some time. And in fact, it's intuitively obvious if economic growth has depended so much on cheap fossil fuel energy, we know that fossil fuels are finite. They are a non-renewable resource. Therefore, you know, we can argue about how long they'll last or what, you know, what portions of the resource we may ultimately be able to extract using new technologies and so on. And of course, these are discussions that are going on all the time. But in the end, we're only talking about the margins. Sooner or later, we will find ourselves without fossil fuels. So the question is this a picture also of what's going to happen to the human economy and human population and all the rest? Well, nobody knows the answer to that question. You know, maybe we can develop renewable energy sources to enable us to keep growing or level off or you know, make the decline curve more gentle. That's really the most important discussion of the 21st century. We know that fossil fuels are actually getting more scarce and expensive in real time. The discussion about fossil fuel depletion is not so much one of theory and forecast as just sort of noting what's going on. For the United States, this is mostly history. We were the first country to drill a commercial oil well back in 1859 in Pennsylvania. Okay, this is where the oil industry started. For the first few decades, not only was the U.S. the world's foremost oil producing nation, we were the world's foremost oil exporting nation. And I'm talking here mostly about oil because oil has become the most important of the fossil fuels. It's the most energy dense. And we use it for transportation, and transportation has become so central to our economy. Not only cars and planes, but also the transport of all the products and resources that are traded. So trade depends upon transport, and transport depends upon oil. Okay, U.S. oil discoveries peaked in 1930. And U.S. oil production peaked 40 years later in 1970. It's been going generally downhill ever since. It's not that we stopped looking. And in fact, huge new discoveries were made in the U.S. in the 1970s and 80s, first in Alaska, the North Slope of Alaska, and then deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico. These added little bumps on the downward slope, but they didn't change the overall trajectory. The U.S. peaked out at a little under 10 million barrels per day, and we're currently producing about 5.6 million barrels per day of crude oil. Now, the same thing is happening in other countries around the world. World oil discoveries peaked in 1964. Again, it's not that we've stopped looking, and it's not that we have stopped finding oil. Oil is still being found in offshore, off the coast of Brazil, in the Gulf of Guinea, off West Africa, in Arctic regions. We're developing new technology to scrape the bottom of the barrel more effectively. You know, the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, it's a big success story, producing 400,000 barrels of oil in North Dakota. Who would have thunk? Of course, if you're using 18 million barrels of oil per day, 400,000 barrels, you know, it helps, but it's not going to make you oil independent. That's not going to make up for all the oil that we're importing now from Canada and Venezuela and all those other countries. But the problem is that those other countries that we're importing oil from, they're also seeing the same process happen. So Indonesia, for example, was a founding member of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Wars were fought over the oil in Indonesia. Well, Indonesia has become a net oil importer now, as the United States is. We're seeing this again in country after country. So what's happening in total is that world oil production has leveled off. Starting around 2004, 2005, the world isn't producing really noticeably any more crude oil today than it was 6 years ago. And that's in the context of very high oil prices. Now, the oil industry has changed. This is what it looked like in the 1930s, you know, a few wooden derricks and people with not much training drilling holes in the sand wherever they thought there might be something worth poking at. This is what the oil industry looks like today, drilling under miles of ocean water and then more miles of rock, situations where a single exploratory well can cost $500 million to drill and still might come up dry. So the oil industry needs high oil prices these days just to go looking. This is a slide from the International Energy Agency, and the all those nice colored bars, that's all of the oil that we know about. It's conventional oil, unconventional oil, OPEC oil, non-OPEC oil, and as you can see, right about 2012, all of those nice colored bands just start dropping off. But not to worry, because the International Energy Agency assures us that we'll still be able to continue growing world oil supplies from unidentified projects. Now, we don't know what those projects are or where they are. Certainly, some unidentified projects will be discovered and you know, put into production, but we really don't know where or in what quantity. What I take away from this slide is we, as a nation, the United States, has a faith-based energy policy.
That was Richard Heinberg, author, journalist, and best known for his impeccably researched writing on fossil fuel depletion. He spoke on December 1st, 2011, about his most recent book, The End of Growth. Come back when TUC Radio returns for Heinberg's take on the Occupy movement. Richard Heinberg is Senior Fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. His website is richardheinberg.com. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD or a one-hour film on DVD of Richard Heinberg on the End of Growth by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation, CD or DVD order, keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.